I want you to imagine something for a second. Go into your bathroom, open your medicine cabinet, and pull out a standard over-the-counter bottle of cough syrup. You know, just a regular generic bottle you bought the last time you had a winter cold.
Right.
Look at the label. What if I told you that you aren't just holding a mild 1950s cough remedy? What if that exact same molecule in your hand simultaneously functions as a potent recreational dissociative hallucinogen and also serves as the engine for a revolutionary, newly FDA-approved psychiatric medicine?
It sounds completely contradictory, honestly. I mean, we are so heavily conditioned to view drugs as having a single rigid identity. You know, you take an analgesic for pain, an antipyretic for a fever, a cough suppressant for a cough.
Yeah.
But molecular chemistry doesn't really care about the neat little labels we stick on plastic bottles.
Exactly. And okay, let's unpack this, because that structural reality is exactly what we are exploring in today's deep dive. We're looking at a really comprehensive recent analysis from the OOTW Journal that details the neuroscience of dextromethorphan, which most people just know as DXM.
Right, DXM.
And our mission today is to track how dose, chemistry, and one highly unpredictable liver enzyme basically turn a single compound into three completely distinct medical and cultural stories. We are talking about a substance that has been sitting quietly in almost every American home since, well, since the Eisenhower administration.
It really is hiding in plain sight.
Yeah.
And to appreciate the scope of DXM, we really have to strip away its everyday reputation. I mean, if you only view it as the stuff that tastes like artificial cherries and stops a tickle in your throat, you are missing a staggeringly complex pharmacological profile.
Oh, absolutely.
The drug most people think they know is merely the surface of a deeply intricate neurochemical system.
So let's start with how this compound even ended up in our medicine cabinets in the first place. Because it wasn't some random discovery by a consumer brand trying to cure the sniffles, right? The origin story actually starts with the U.S. military in the mid-1950s.
Right. And the landscape of medicine back then was quite different. The standard of care for a severe cough was codeine.
Which is an opiate.
Exactly. Codeine is an opiate.
Yeah.
It is highly effective at suppressing the medullary cough center in the brain, but it carries the heavy baggage of opioid addiction and sedation. So the U.S. Navy and the CIA jointly funded research to find a synthetic substitute.
Wait, the Navy and the CIA?
Yeah, they needed a molecule that could shut down a cough reflex without turning the patient, or in their case, the soldier, into an opioid addict.
Wow. Okay, so you have the Navy and the CIA essentially hunting for a non-addictive opioid. And they started looking at the morphinine class of chemicals, which are structurally very, very close to opioids. But they utilized this fascinating quirk of molecular physics to basically bypass the addiction pathway.
That quirk is known as chirality, or handedness.
Right.
Many complex molecules exist in two forms that are exact mirror images of each other, just like your left and right hands. They have the same atoms connected in the same order, but they are flipped in three-dimensional space. So DXM is the right-handed mirror image of a highly potent, highly addictive opioid called levofenyl.
Okay, so think of it like it's like trying to shove a left shoe onto your right foot.
That's a good way to look at it.
Right. If your brain's U-opioid receptor, which is the one responsible for pain relief, euphoria, and addiction, if that's the right foot, levofenyl fits perfectly.
Right.
But DXM is the left shoe. It has all the same leather and laces, but it's facing the wrong direction in space, so it just bounces right off the receptor.
Exactly. It exerts practically zero opioid activity.
Which is wild.
It is. And that spatial mismatch is what made it a medical triumph in the 1950s. Hmm. It retains the ability to cross the blood-brain barrier and quiet the cough reflex, but completely ignores the addiction pathway. So it was swiftly approved by the FDA as an over-the-counter, non-narcotic product in 1958, originally marketed as Romilar. And for decades, the medical establishment viewed it as incredibly safe and, frankly, profoundly boring.
But the reality is that DXM was never boring. I mean, its main action in the brain has nothing to do with coughing at all. It acts as an uncompetitive NMDA receptor antagonist. Now, for anyone listening who might not be a neuropharmacologist, the NMDA receptor is a critical docking station for glutamate, which is the brain's primary excitatory neurotransmitter.
Right. It drives a lot of the brain's activity.
Yeah. And by blocking this receptor, DXM joins a very specific, intense family of drugs.
It does. When you antagonize the NMDA receptor, you are interrupting the flow of sensory information between the body and the conscious mind. This is the defining mechanism of dissociative anesthetics.
Like ketamine.
Exactly. We're talking about ketamine, PCP, and nitrous oxide.
Yeah.
DXM shares this exact baseline mechanism.
It's just wild to think that a chemical cousin to PCP is sitting right there next to your toothpaste. But it isn't just an NMDA antagonist, right? It is a massive multi-target molecule.
Very much so.
It acts as a sigma-1 receptor agonist, which we now know plays a huge role in cellular stress and neuroplasticity. It's also an SNRI, a serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor, much like popular antidepressant medications. And it's a nicotinic acetylcholine receptor antagonist.
It's a very busy molecule.
Yeah. It's like thinking you hired a simple plumber to fix a leak, but you find out they're also a master electrician, a structural engineer, and an architect, seamlessly redesigning your entire house all at once.
That's a great analogy. That multi-target profile is exactly what makes it so powerful. But having this master key molecule in your brain is totally useless if your body immediately identifies it as a threat and destroys it.
Right.
Which brings us to the fatal biological flaw that kept DXM out of psychiatry for decades. We have to look at the human liver.
Oh, this is where it gets intensely personal for you, the listener. Because when you swallow a dose of DXM, your biological experience is basically dictated by a genetic lottery.
It really is. The moment DXM hits your bloodstream, it is routed through the liver, where a specific enzyme called CYP2D6 goes to work on it.
CYP2D6.
Right. Think of this enzyme as a very aggressive bouncer. Its sole job is to strip a tiny methyl group, just a carbon atom and a few hydrogens, off the dextromethorphan molecule. When that methyl group is removed, the drug is transformed into its major active metabolite, which is dextrorphan.
And that structural change might seem minor, but it alters the drug's electrical profile completely, doesn't it?
Completely.
Because dextrorphan is actually a much more potent NMDA antagonist than the parent drug itself. So the heavy dissociative lifting is primarily being done by what your liver actually turns the cough syrup into.
Yes, and what's fascinating here is that human beings have wild genetic variability regarding how many of these CYPTT6 bouncers they actually produce. You have people who are poor metabolizers, who barely produce functional versions of this enzyme, all the way up to ultra-rapid metabolizers whose livers just chew through the drug instantly.
Wait, does this mean if I take a standard spoonful of cough syrup, my biological experience could be drastically different from yours just based on a genetic game of liver roulette?
That is exactly what it means.
That's crazy. Let's put some numbers to that, because the contrast in the OOTW data is staggering. In a normal metabolizer, the elimination half-life of DXM, you know, the time it takes your body to clear half the dose, is roughly 6.6 hours.
Right.
But if you fall into the poor metabolizer category, that half-life extends to 29.5 hours.
That discrepancy is massive. I mean, for a normal metabolizer, standard dose is processed and cleared so cleanly it barely registers long-term. But for a poor metabolizer, taking that same dose every 12 hours means the drug just accumulates and accumulates in the bloodstream. This variability is so widely documented that researchers actually use DXM as a biological probe. Well, if they need to test a patient's natural liver function, they administer a controlled dose of DXM and simply measure the metabolic exhaust.
Oh, I see. But if you are a pharmaceutical researcher looking at DXM's incredible receptor profile and you want to use it to treat chronic brain diseases, this genetic roulette is your biggest nightmare.
Oh, absolutely.
You cannot commercialize a psychiatric medication if it lasts 6 hours in one patient and 30 hours in the person sitting right next to them.
No, you need stability. You need predictable drug levels in the brain to drive neuroplasticity and symptom relief. So since scientists couldn't rely on the natural genetic distribution of the liver, they developed a workaround. They engineered combination medicines specifically designed to artificially turn everyone into a poor metabolizer.
They basically hacked the liver. By pairing DXM with a second drug whose only purpose is to occupy and block that CYP2D6 enzyme, they shielded the DXM. And the first time we saw this successfully commercialized was in 2010 with a medication called Nudexta.
Right, Nudexta. It combines 20 milligrams of DXM with 10 milligrams of quinidine. Now, quinidine is primarily an older antiarrhythmic heart medication.
Okay.
But at this incredibly low dose, it doesn't affect the heart at all. It just acts as a decoy, keeping the CYP2D6 enzymes busy so the DXM can slip past the liver and reach the brain intact.
And Nudexta isn't for a cough, obviously. It was approved to treat pseudobulbar effect, or PBA.
Correct.
For those unfamiliar, PBA is a deeply distressing neurological condition, often resulting from ALS, multiple sclerosis, or severe traumatic brain injuries. It essentially disconnects the brain's emotional state from its physical expression, leading to these uncontrollable fits of laughing or crying that don't match how the patient actually feels inside.
It's devastating for patients. But Nudexta successfully stabilizes those misfiring neural circuits and dramatically reduces PBA episodes. What is really remarkable, though, is that the FDA label explicitly acknowledges that the exact mechanism of action for resolving PBA is still unknown.
Wait, really? They don't know how it works?
Not entirely. I mean, we know the receptor profile and we know the clinical outcome, but the exact pathway of healing remains a bit of a black box.
Wow. It's a testament to the fact that clinical efficacy often outpaces our fundamental mapping of the brain. But the application of DXM that is actively rewriting modern psychiatry arrived much more recently in August of 2022 with a drug called Auvelity, which was developed as AXS-05.
Yes, Auvelity. It utilizes the exact same metabolic hack, but instead of quinidine, it pairs DXM with bupropion.
Okay.
Bupropion, which people might recognize by the brand name Wellbutrin, is a well-established antidepressant in its own right, and it is also a potent CYP2D6 inhibitor. The FDA approved this combination as the very first oral NMDA receptor antagonist for major depressive disorder.
Which is huge. We are talking about a genuinely novel mechanism of action for depression after relying almost exclusively on SSRIs for 30 years.
Exactly.
And the data from the GEMINI clinical trial was incredibly robust. At week 6, 39.5% of patients on Auvelity achieved clinical remission, compared to just 17.3% on placebo. But the real paradigm shift here isn't just the remission rate, it's the velocity, right? They demonstrated statistically significant separation from the placebo in just 1 to 2 weeks.
In the context of severe depression, a two-week response time is revolutionary.
Yeah.
Traditional SSRIs require 4 to 8 weeks of constant dosing to properly modulate serotonin levels and stimulate downstream neuroplasticity.
Yeah.
So cutting that wait time down drastically reduces the window of acute suffering for patients.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. I want to push back on the hype for a second. If Auvelity is an NMDA antagonist and it induces rapid antidepressant effects, is the pharmaceutical industry basically just giving us a daily ketamine pill and wrapping it in a more palatable brand name?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it is very tempting to view it as oral ketamine, especially given the recent explosion of intravenous ketamine clinics.
Right.
There is undeniably a mechanistic kinship there. Both drugs antagonize the NMDA receptor, which triggers a surge in glutamate signaling and rapid synaptic growth. However, the binding affinity and the clinical effect sizes of Auvelity are much more modest than a high-dose ketamine infusion. The rapid-onset ketamine comparison is a solid scientific hypothesis, but the psychiatric community is still mapping the exact boundaries of how these two compounds differ in long-term use.
Okay, so it's an important distinction. It isn't a magic wand, but it's a vital new lever to pull. And the development pipeline hasn't stopped either. Just a few months ago, on April 30, 2026, the FDA expanded Auvelity's approval to treat agitation in Alzheimer's dementia,
which represents a massive shift in geriatric care. Historically, when Alzheimer's patients exhibit severe agitation or aggression, physicians have leaned heavily on off-label, atypical antipsychotics. And those drugs carry a black box warning for elderly patients with dementia due to increased mortality risks. So Auvelity provides the first FDA-approved non-antipsychotic alternative.
But getting that approval wasn't exactly a clean sweep. The data presents a very complicated picture. The FDA based its approval on the ACCORD 2 trial, which showed significant positive results. Yet a separate trial in 2024, known as ADVANCE 2, entirely missed its primary endpoint.
Right.
How does a drug fundamentally fail one trial and succeed in another for the exact same condition?
It speaks to the inherent difficulty of measuring psychiatric symptoms in neurodegenerative decline. Agitation is not like blood pressure. You know, you can't just hook up a monitor and get an objective number.
Right, subjective.
Very subjective. It is evaluated through rating scales, often reliant on caregivers who are dealing with immense burnout. Plus, placebo responses in dementia trials are notoriously high, and a patient's baseline agitation can fluctuate wildly day to day. A missed endpoint doesn't necessarily mean the drug has zero dialogical effect. It often means the statistical noise of the trial design just drowned out the signal.
And the FDA ultimately looked at the totality of the evidence and decided the signal in ACCORD 2 was strong enough to justify the approval, especially given the sheer lack of safe alternative.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've covered the carefully engineered combination therapies that are healing the brain. Now we have to look at what happens when those safety guardrails are removed. Because DXM is still legally sitting on pharmacy shelves, we have to address its third identity, which is a potent recreational drug.
And because of its accessibility, DXM has a long, complicated history of misuse, primarily among adolescents. When individuals consume doses drastically higher than the therapeutic 10 to 30 milligram range, the pharmacology shifts entirely away from cough suppression and firmly into the dissociative spectrum.
Right. Toxicology reports and user experiences consistently break this escalation down into four distinct plateaus. The first plateau occurs around 100 to 200 milligrams. This is generally characterized by mild stimulation, a bit of restlessness, and slight euphoria.
Then pushing into the second plateau, which is around 200 to 400 milligrams, users report a state heavily resembling alcohol intoxication.
Like slurred speech.
Yeah, significant motor impairment, slurred speech, and closed-eye visual hallucinations.
And it is at the third plateau, spanning 300 to 600 milligrams, where the NMDA blockade really becomes dominant. Users experience profound dissociation. They report feeling entirely disconnected from their physical bodies and their environment, often losing the ability to process language or coordinate movement at all.
Right. And then the fourth plateau, which involves doses upwards of 500 to 1,000 milligrams plus, induces a near-total anesthetic state, heavily mirroring the deep dissociation of a clinical ketamine or PCP dose.
Colloquially, this is known as robo-tripping or skittling. Now, the immediate reaction is to focus on the psychological danger of the hallucinations. But from a harm reduction and toxicology standpoint, the genuine physical threats to life are rarely the dissociative trips themselves.
No, they aren't.
The true danger stems directly from the secondary mechanisms of the molecule and the physical syrup it is dissolved in.
First, we have to revisit that SNRI mechanism, because DXM blocks the reuptake of serotonin, taking recreational doses while also taking prescription antidepressants, particularly SSRIs or MAOIs, can trigger serotonin syndrome.
And this isn't just a mild interaction. Serotonin syndrome is a cascading medical emergency. When the synapses are flooded with too much serotonin, the autonomic nervous system just goes haywire.
It does. Patients present with hyperthermia, which are dangerously high fevers, severe muscle rigidity, rapid heart rates, and delirium. It can be fatal if not immediately treated with serotonin antagonists and supportive cooling. That SNRI action is precisely why Nudexta and Auvelity carry extremely strict contraindications against combining them with other serotonergic medications.
That makes sense.
But the second, and arguably more frequent danger, is the combination product problem.
Right. This is the grim reality of how the drug is packaged. People chasing a DXM high are rarely consuming pure dextromethorphan. They are usually chugging vast quantities of multi-symptom cold and flu syrups. It's like trying to get a massive caffeine rush by drinking 20 lattes, but every single latte comes with a side of toxic sludge. The caffeine isn't what destroys your liver, it's the sludge-riding shotgun in the bottle.
Exactly. And in this case, the most common sludge is acetaminophen, the active ingredient in Tylenol. In normal doses, it's perfectly safe. But if the massive dose is found in multiple bottles of cough syrup, it rapidly depletes the liver's stores of glutathione.
And what happens then?
Well, without glutathione, the liver cells essentially suffocate in their own toxic waste, leading to acute, irreversible hepatic necrosis. Acetaminophen poisoning is actually a leading cause of liver failure in the United States, often driven by this exact type of misuse.
That is terrifying. And there is also the profound danger of chlorpheniramine, right, which is a first-generation antihistamine famously found in Triple C or Coricide in cough and cold. Taking a recreational dose of that specific product floods the body with an anticholinergic toxin.
Yes.
The classic medical phrase for anticholinergic toxicity is dry as a bone, blind as a bat, red as a beet, mad as a hatter. It causes severe cardiac arrhythmias, grand mal seizures, and absolute delirium.
Emergency room physicians will tell you that the most severe life-threatening DXM overdoses they treat are almost always driven by the co-ingredients, not the dextromethorphan itself. The danger is deeply contextual. It relies on the total milligram load, the other active chemicals in the syrup, and, crucially, whether that specific teenager happens to be a poor CYP2D6 metabolizer.
Because if they are, those toxic levels would linger for days.
Exactly.
So when you look at the sheer scale of the toxicity, the plateaus, and the ease of access, the obvious question is why the federal government hasn't stepped in to regulate this like a Schedule II narcotic. But the regulatory history is actually quite nuanced.
Very much so. In 2010, the FDA convened a specialized advisory committee to formally debate whether DXM should be scheduled under the Controlled Substances Act. And after reviewing all the abuse data and the toxicology reports, they actually voted against scheduling it.
It really comes down to a fundamental calculation of harm versus access. The committee recognized the abuse potential, but they reasoned that locking DXM behind a prescription pad would place a massive undue burden on the millions of Americans who use these products safely and correctly every single year for standard illnesses.
Right. The FDA opted for public education and warning labels over federal restriction.
But the regulatory gap was eventually filled at the state level, right? Recognizing the adolescent abuse rates, California became the first state in 2012 to legally ban the sale of pure DXM products to minors. Today, over 20 states have implemented similar laws, requiring a buyer to be 18 or older and present ID at the pharmacy counter.
It serves as a practical speed bump. It preserves access for adults while structurally removing it from middle school social circles.
So what does this all mean? We have covered an incredible amount of ground today. We've tracked a molecule from the CIA laboratories of the 1950s through the genetic lotteries of the human liver, straight into the cutting-edge clinical trials for Alzheimer's and depression, and down into the grim reality of emergency room toxicology.
I think the ultimate takeaway from the OOTW Journal's analysis is that dextromethorphan completely dismantles the idea of a simple drug. A molecule is defined entirely by its context. Its identity shifts based on the precise milligram dose, the specific metabolic machinery of the person digesting it, and the other pharmacological agents it is paired with. It manages to be an unremarkable medicine cabinet staple, a severe dissociative, and a genuine pioneer in modern psychiatry, all at exactly the same time.
It completely reframes how you look at that sticky red bottle in your bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And it leaves me with this thought to mull over. We just spent decades aggressively overlooking a profoundly powerful psychiatric tool that was sitting right there in almost every home in America since 1958.
Yeah.
If a simple, boring 1950s cough syrup held the biological secret to rapidly treating depression and Alzheimer's agitation, what other ordinary, ignored, over-the-counter compounds are hiding revolutionary medical breakthroughs right under our noses, just waiting for the right scientific lens to unlock them?